You ever come across anything like time travel?
Easy. I've already looked into it for myself.
Right on.
Oh boy, it's a time travel podcast. My name is Nate, and with me is a co-host who always reads between the lines. It's Brian Martin.
Yeah, you gotta, man. I like how you're still trying to fight yourself against calling this a Quantum Leap podcast.
I got it written down. I guess you saw my eyes look down. I've got it written down. Make sure that you say time travel.
It's tattooed on his arm like Memento.
Yeah. Or carved into my arm like Looper.
Like Looper. Mm. Or Time Cop.
Or Time Cop. Yeah, I guess
the carving
would work
works
for Time
the same
Cop
way
also.
In Time Cop. So I got to believe that's where Rian Johnson got the idea from.
It's true.
Time Cop. Very influential movie.
Very influential. Yeah, well, that's what we're talking about tonight. Jean-Claude Van Damme.
JCVD.
Yeah.
It's exciting to be able to talk about the muscles from Brussels. Never thought we'd get to it.
Well, yeah.
But here we are. And I joke, but I think that Time Cop is a nice, let's call it an aperitif, or maybe a nice dessert wine following Looper. They just pair very nicely together.
Surprisingly so. I wouldn't have thought so to begin with, but yeah, they really kind of do, actually.
Rian Johnson probably saw Time Cop at some point and thought, what if I made this, but intelligently? And then the end result was Looper.
That's an interesting take. Intelligently? Because
part of it, the time travel itself is much more explained in Time Cop very directly.
Yes.
And Rian Johnson saw Time Cop and said, I'd like to take that part out and also the dumb dialogue and then turn it into something viable.
Well, I would question explained or not whether it makes any more sense than Looper did.
I can make more sense of the time travel at work in this movie. I've broken it down a little bit more in my notes.
Right. You can tell what they're trying to say.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. 1994. What was this movie about?
It was about an hour and 40.
Tell me what this movie was about, Brian.
So this movie, as Nate said, released in 1994, directed by Peter Hyams, who is known for movies like 2010, The Year We Make Contact, and The Relic. What I'm saying is Time Cop is probably his best known movie.
You don't think people know Relic?
I think people do know The Relic. But I don't know that people outside of the 90s know Relic.
But do people outside of the 90s know Time Cop?
They're about to. I feel like JCVD lives on, you know?
Yeah,
like
he did have that television series, like a short-lived miniseries or something, where he played himself as a spy.
Yes.
It's supposed to be pretty good.
And then there was the movie JCVD, where he, as himself, foils a bank robbery, which is also terrific. It's a terrific movie.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that one.
So this is not the only time travel movie that Peter Hyams directed. He also directed the notoriously bad 2005 A Sound of Thunder, which is, boy oh boy, is it rough.
We'll get
to that one at some point. It starred Ben Kingsley and Edward Burns. If you remember Edward Burns, there was a moment where we thought he was going to be the next Ben Affleck. But then Ben Affleck just kept being Ben Affleck and Edward Burns went away.
Well, we can't keep watching these gems.
That's true. That's true.
We're going to have to mix in some garbage here and there.
So written by Mark Verheiden and Mike Richardson. Mark Verheiden actually wrote the comic series that this movie is based on. He was a pretty prolific comic writer. And he also later wrote for Battlestar Galactica and Smallville.
Was kind of waiting on you to give me the history of this comic book writer. Does he make anybody famous? Did he invent any characters that we all know today?
Yeah, Time Cop. Fuck yeah, what do you
I
think we're talking
even
about?
Know, did you know that going in, that it was a comic first?
I knew it when the movie came out.
Yeah, I didn't.
Based on a comic, but it's based on a comic the way Mystery Men and Men in Black are based on comics, where it's like, oh, that was a comic?
Yeah, you know? After I found out that that's what it was, I did a little research to, like, compare it against the comic book, and it really was, like, a lot of these 90s comic book adaptations, yeah, a lot of this content was getting adapted, but nobody knew that because it was so different than the actual published work. Like, right now, Marvel Cinematic Universe, the DC Extended Universe, they're trying to be as faithful as possible in order to draw in.
And these are also characters that have been recognized as comic book characters predominantly for decades and decades.
Right. But back in this era, it was more like, it's a comic book, so we've got to make it a movie. We've got to do something different. We can't just put a comic book on the screen.
And there's also no comic books about this coming out at the time that would lead you to, if you liked this, go to your local comic shop and read Mystery Men. You couldn't do that. Bob Burton's Mystery Men series was out of print.
Yeah.
Men in Black, I think there was like a one-shot that Marvel released because they had bought Malibu Comics.
Malibu was, Men in Black.
They were the ones who had the rights to Men in Black, and they released a single issue that collected the Men in Black indie book that was released with a new Rob Liefeld cover on it.
Do you know how close that was to the movie?
It was not close at all. It's just completely different. It's a like in name only. It's kind of like the Mr. and Mrs. Smith conundrum of a few weeks ago.
I feel like that's like what a lot of the adaptations were. Almost in name only, because this was basically the main character's name, and that's about it, as compared to the comic book, from what I read.
His name is Time Cop. Only ever had one destiny. Jean-Claude Van Damme is playing a character named Max Walker, which, I don't know if you've ever been to Belgium, but is not the most Belgian name for a man who's clearly from Belgium to have.
Yeah.
You know that this guy's big selling point is not his acting chops.
Right.
He is like the action movie Tommy Wiseau. He just shows up. He can't really act. He's got this accent that is just almost not understandable at points.
They make a point of that. They actually mention it in the movie, which I thought was fun.
They drag this guy over his accent, but his name is Max Walker.
Yeah, maybe he Americanized it when he immigrated to the States.
Maybe so. But the one thing we do know about Jean-Claude Van Damme, regardless, is that he is a hunk. He's a good-looking guy, and that explains how he landed Mia Sara in this movie, who plays his wife, Melissa. Mm.
Stole Mia Sara. From Ferris Bueller.
Sloane, man. She's always going to be Sloane. She's always going to be the unattainable girl that we loved. Between her and Phoebe Cates, I can't imagine who else in the 80s would have been that level of crush object. It's hard for me to fathom. But anyway, there she is in all of her ageless glory. She just looks so great in this movie.
Well, it was from 1994.
I mean, but yeah, I'm thinking like Ferris Bueller was what, like 86?
Yeah.
This is almost 10 years later, and man. Anyway, Ron Silver is also in this movie playing your villain, Senator McComb.
Yes.
Also appearing. Maybe we are the biggest podcasting proponents of this actor, unless he has his own podcast or a podcast devoted to him.
Ooh, we should look into that.
Bruce McGill. As Matuszek, who is the guy that runs the Time Enforcement Commission. So the plot of this movie is that time travel has been discovered in the year 1994 by a... Was this a Project Paperclip guy, like one of those Nazis that came over and helped...
Had something to do with like rockets or whatnot.
Well, his name was Dr. Heinz Kleindost, and he worked on rockets, got us to the moon... And he's been working on time travel for 20 years. So since the mid-70s, this guy's been working on time travel. Now,
1994, that's an interesting year.
Yeah, it's also the year the movie came out. How about that? They did like the Star Trek 4 angle where it's like, let's just have them walk around L.A.
And the modern era of OG Quantum Leap.
That's true. That's true.
Time travel got invented in 94.
Yeah, I don't think Quantum Leap is what inspired this movie. I think the reason the studio wanted to make this movie was Terminator 2.
Yeah.
That's the time travel thing that people were like, we need a time travel.
Yeah, they needed a vehicle for him.
Yeah, they even have a scene in this where a villain is menacingly marching down the back hallway at a mall. Like, that's how on the nose it is.
Not nearly as cool, mind you.
No. So Heinz Kleindost, obviously paperclip guy, working on time travel for 20 years. Look, Dial of Destiny came out last year. The whole plot of the movie is that a Nazi wants to go back and win World War II. What do we think this Nazi's going to do with time travel, right? He wants to go back and win World War II. He's an ex-Nazi.
You never see him in the movie, though.
No, we have no idea who this man is, because he is described to us by a very young Scott Lawrence, who you guys might remember, those of you in the Belisario verse.
That's right.
He was on JAG. So,
among others.
So all of you Belisario stands out there might remember Scott Lawrence from JAG.
No, this is Tibby Johnson.
It's true. Okay. I mean, he's been in a lot.
Tibby Johnson on Quantum Leap, the young man in the asylum who Al had to teach to read. He taught him the alphabet rap.
That is right.
Ever since that episode, I've recognized that guy. He's just got a recognizable face, and he's been in so much stuff. I'm like, there's that guy. That's the guy. He's from Quantum Leap.
He's definitely one of the best that guy actors.
And he's
two Quantum Leap alums.
Yes. Exactly. And this guy's been playing Darth Vader in video games since like 1998.
Yeah.
All the way up through now.
But when you see the single scene in this movie that he appears in, oh, he's got the voice.
Well, he's got a couple of scenes. He's got two.
This guy came in to be a voice and to say lines quickly and authoritatively.
Yeah.
We got to find an actor who can deliver these with gravitas and without taking a breath.
Right. But we can't pay him.
Right.
If you can't get James Earl Jones, go ahead and get the guy that plays Vader in the video game.
Scott Lawrence shows up and tells a Senate subcommittee all about time travel, and they ridicule it.
Time travel.
Yeah, time travel.
Well, beam me up, Scotty.
That's very funny, Senator. You want to know what's funnier than that, though?
I get the feeling he's going to tell us.
The funny thing is, the good doctor actually did it.
One guy, time travel. Well, beam me up, Scotty, which is exactly the sort of dumbass thing a senator would say, because you're conflating two different sci-fi concepts there. It immediately reminded me of that time on The Simpsons where Mayor Quimby met Leonard Nimoy, and he was like, I just want to say, may the force be with you. And Leonard Nimoy was like, do you even know who I am? I think so. Weren't you one of the little rascals? That was the kind of energy it had.
A solar eclipse. The cosmic ballet goes on.
Does anyone want to switch seats?
Speaking of energy, this scene, this expository dump of a scene at the very beginning of the movie is terrific.
Yeah.
It's the kind of scene that can just fucking drown a movie. Because
it could. Certainly could.
It's nothing but exposition.
Yeah.
But Scott Lawrence delivers it perfectly.
Succinctly.
Everything makes sense by the end, and you even see the moment where Senator McComb puts his whole plan together.
Yeah.
It's so efficient, and I swear to God, I watched the scene, and Scott Lawrence, he made the movie. There is no functional time cop movie without Scott Lawrence in it, because he carries that first scene and makes us want to see the rest of it.
Yeah, that's fair.
He's so good in it.
We should come back to that for sure.
We quickly meet Max Walker and Melissa in a scene that is a little bit creepy at first, because he just kind of sneaks up behind her and says some very awkward things, but then you find out, they're married. It's okay. They can be weird in public, I guess.
Right.
They go back to their very nice house and make passionate love to one another.
A nice house with like 9 lives.
Yeah. Walker is assaulted by some goons outside the house.
Goons is right.
This movie is lousy with goons. There are so many goons in this movie.
I prefer the hands-on touch you only get with hired goons.
Hired goons?
Mia Sara is kept inside the house by these nefarious goons, and then the house explodes, and we fast forward 10 years, where Walker is now a member of the Time Enforcement Commission, working under Eugene Matuszek, and going through the timeline, and let's say putting right things that maybe bad actors are putting wrong.
Yes.
Because time travel exists and the TEC, I guess, wasn't fast enough to stop some, you know, ne'er-do-wells from going back in time and mucking with things.
Right. Now, there's a good scene where our villain, well, I guess it's just been revealed that he's the actual villain, McCombs. And there's a really good scene where he makes a legitimate argument with regards to time travel.
But you see, what I propose is far less costly. It accomplishes the same thing. Why don't we just prevent time travel rather than spending stupendous amounts of money trying to police it?
I feel like it was a logical argument. Like it's a logical government argument. And like you're spending all this money to try and police people traveling through time. We need to just not do it.
Yeah.
And spend money on preventing it, not policing it.
Yes.
But I liked it. I thought that was good.
It was Senator McComb in particular. There are some very prescient moments in the movie that I didn't expect to resonate as well today as they did.
Oh, yeah.
There's one monologue that McComb has near the end of the movie.
His platform.
His whole presidential platform sounds, I don't know, vaguely familiar. But we'll definitely get to that. So, yes, it isn't long into this movie before Walker discovers that McComb is trying to manipulate history to position himself to win the presidency in 2004. And there are some clever ways that they discover timeline ripples, these little moments in history that seem to be altering things.
Yeah.
As he goes back in time, some or sends this, agents back in time to manipulate.
Some of this history. Movie is really creative.
It's very creative, some very clever stuff at work. But this movie really does come down to, can McComb's tampering with history outpace Walker's ability to prove what's going on and stop McComb?
Right.
From what he's doing. And part of what McComb's doing, those goons didn't come out of nowhere, is trying to kill Walker and kill his wife. So Walker's quest also becomes one of righteous vengeance.
Well, general feelings.
I don't hate it.
I don't hate it either.
I definitely don't hate this movie. There's a couple reasons why, right? One, we've already touched on. I think a lot of the time travel elements in this movie are clever. And what they're trying to do is interesting.
Yeah.
Two, as a mid-90s action movie, it feels a little bit dated, but it feels definitely at home with 80s action movies. This feels like one of the last of its breed in the Cineplex.
Yeah, sure.
And I like that. I like that feel. I like the movie you can go to and get some cool action scenes, some neat set pieces, some good one-liners. Now, one of the problems with this movie is that...
And some bad one-liners.
None of the good one-liners are delivered by JCVD. Not a single one. It's like an AI could have written this because it's the most generic, obvious thing.
But also just off a little bit. It's like...
It doesn't speak to the moment. They're all interchangeable.
Yeah, I feel
you know,
like
that's not
they're...
what a one-liner is.
Except for that freeze one.
The freeze. I should have said freeze. And that's what I typed in my notes. This motherfucker should have said freeze.
Yeah.
But, I said, I guess we're still like 3 years away from good freeze puns because Batman and Robin was still 3 years out at this point.
Yeah, I mean, there are some good one-liners, but there are also some really bad ones in here.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh,
not
God.
Just from JCVD, you know. I will say, my history with this movie, and I didn't mention this when you suggested it, but this was the first R-rated movie that I saw in the theater.
Wow. That's some real Nate trivia. You know the first R-rated movie I saw in the theater?
I don't.
Schindler's List.
Wait, say that. What?
Schindler's List.
Schindler's List?
That was the first R-rated movie I watched in the theater.
I like my experience better.
You had a more traditional experience. You know, I mean, it came out
Schindler's
in like 93.
Schindler's List.
So many R-rated movies that kids would want to sneak into. I mean, movies like Sliver or like Showgirls and shit like that. I'm the one that's like, I would like one for Schindler's List, please. Yeah, that was it. That was it.
This was the perfect first R-rated movie because it's like action, people get killed, it's Jean-Claude Van Damme, but there's also some boobs in there.
There's some boobs.
You know?
There's that tech guy who likes VR porn.
Yeah, man. I always remember this movie. I feel like I might have been able to have this podcast without having rewatched it.
That's interesting. Yeah.
I was impressionable because that is, I think, the last time I honestly watched the whole thing until now. I don't know if it's just in the zeitgeist of popular media. you just remember all this stuff, or it really did just impact me that way. But there's so much in this movie that you just remember.
Yes.
Like the truck diving under the semi-truck.
Uh-huh.
The splits, obviously, every time he does the splits. But yeah, my first R-rated movie. Good times.
All right, so you remember this movie. It's very fused into your head. For those of you who maybe didn't see the movie in 94 or only have vague memories of it, you probably remember one thing and one thing only. And if you didn't see it, you knew one thing about this movie. What is it?
The splits.
The split. That's absolutely fucking it.
Yeah.
It's the counter split in the kitchen in his boxers.
Right.
Which is the reason Jean-Claude Van Damme was working in the 90s. The man is peak human physicality.
Yeah.
This guy can deliver on it.
And it's so cool.
Very cool.
I think there's that contingent of the audience out there that would just think it's kind of silly or, oh man, it's so goofy. But I feel like that's still legitimately cool.
It is cool. I feel like he started working because people were like looking for the next Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know?
Yeah, I mean,
scouring Europe for the next Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, Bruce Willis, Sly Stallone, all these larger than life actors from that era. And Van Damme was in there.
Someone who's not an actor.
Chuck Norris.
Somebody who is primarily an athlete or a bodybuilder. And JCVD has the chops, the physical chops, not the acting chops.
I don't know. Like, I agree with you. He's not an actor, but as far as his performances go, this one's not horrendous.
No.
It's not terrible. He's
enjoyable. Like, he's never so bad that he is completely unwatchable.
I don't think he even borders on that at any point in this movie.
Well, the note I made about his acting is that the cast in this movie is so good, you're constantly comparing him to everybody else around him. That's the problem I have.
Well, I know the antagonist is really, really good.
Bruce McGill, Ron Silver, Mia Sara, Gloria Rubin, who plays Fielding, all of them are very good.
See, I didn't like Fielding that much.
She goes out pretty quick.
I don't know. Like, I didn't believe her.
I didn't believe the switch. The switch is not effective, I don't think, when she kind of switches allegiances very quickly.
Yeah, exactly. It's too quick, and then it's too quick switching back.
Okay.
And she's only there a couple of scenes in the middle of the movie, but they're pivotal, but we don't care about her.
Yeah, she does just kind of come and go.
I feel like they try to give her a quick backstory or something so that maybe we'll care about her, but it's not enough.
Yeah.
You're already invested in Max Walker and his wife's story and the antagonist, the villain in the story, and then you bring in this partner just for the double cross.
Who's just from Internal Affairs.
Yeah.
The whole concept is that Walker's partner was bought and paid for by McComb to go back in time and manipulate the stock market to put more money in McComb's campaign coffers.
Right.
For when he's running for president.
Right.
Which is his whole plan, is to send mooks like him back in time and have them gradually funnel money into his campaign.
Right. And because his partner was bought and paid for, they sign him up with another partner who was with Internal Affairs.
Yes.
So somebody that they could really trust, but of course, oh no, you know,
you can't trust anybody. Well, you trust Bruce McGill.
Yeah.
You can always trust Bruce McGill.
Yeah, I mean, you keep waiting for him to turn, but he never does. He is one of the good guys to the end, and he is so good in this movie.
He's just a delight.
If we're still talking performances, I mean, Bruce McGill knocks everything out of the park, but he's just great. He's so fun to watch.
I don't know how to describe his persona, but
like a real person.
Like, you want Bruce McGill to be your uncle. That's how I feel.
Yeah, okay. I feel like the rest of the performances, they're chewing scenery and they're characters.
Okay, yeah.
And Bruce McGill is a person. Like, you could believe that that person walks around and exists.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, agreed.
Nobody believes Max Walker is a person.
No, not at all.
I don't know. I love Bruce McGill in pretty much everything I've seen him in, and doesn't let us down in this one either.
No, especially because every scene with Bruce McGill in it, Jean-Claude Van Damme is also in it.
He's carrying him?
He's carrying him, just carrying him throughout, but it's not in a patronizing way. It's just like, Bruce McGill, makes you believe in Walker more because he believes in Walker.
He's like that athlete that makes all the other players on the team better.
But isn't a grandstander.
Right, exactly.
The heart of the team. There's a lot of great dialogue in the movie, even though it is by design, quote unquote, dumb action. This is kind of the genre that they're going for, but there are some really, really clever lines and some clever ideas, but McGill gets a lot of them. One of my favorites is when he invites Walker over for dinner.
Yeah.
And says, you're allowed to have a life, you know. I read it in a manual someplace. Like, I was like, that's a great line.
I think that's a good line because it's delivered by McGill, personally.
Exactly.
You've mentioned a couple of times that there's great dialogue in here. I think there's a lot of really bad dialogue in here, too.
Well, fuck you, too.
Well, here's another one I love. Walker stops a purse snatcher in the mall near the beginning of the movie. And it's a really squirrely moment. Like, he just holds his foot up. Like, he's going to kick the kid, but how is he going to kick the kid? Because his foot's already up.
It's just like a, hey, look at me. Yeah.
It's a terrible, there's no good dialogue there.
Oh, good. I thought you were going to, I thought that was your argument.
When he comes back, he looks at Mia Sara and says, smart kid, he read my mind. And her response is, with your English, he didn't have much choice.
Yeah, yeah, that's good.
And I was like, all right, that's a zinger. I like that. You can tell these two are in love with each other.
Yeah, that was a good one. I'll give them that one.
People are constantly.
It's lost because you're focusing on what I used as an opening here. Read between the lines.
Read it.
Over between the lines. I should get the fuck out of here.
Good. You know that purse? Doesn't look good on you.
Because you're holding a foot up it. And then it's, I guess it's supposed to be product placement or something, because the guy reads the bottom of his boot, and he's like, Wolverine? And he's like, read between the lines.
And I started thinking, Vol?
what does that mean?
Which part of this am I supposed to be reading? Oh, okay. All right. That didn't make any sense to me, JCVD.
Well, he's a smart kid. He got it.
Yeah.
You know who the best actress in this whole damn movie is? It's that old lady.
Oh, the old lady who gets her purse
that they
snatched?
Give the purse back to.
Yeah, she's pretty good.
She's such a sweet little old lady. Says it all in glance.
Yeah. Another great line. Never interrupt me when I'm talking to myself.
Yeah, or don't argue amongst yourself.
Yes. When old McComb and young McComb.
Whenever they share screen time together, yeah.
Are talking to each other. Something that's really funny about that is that at the beginning, in that first scene when Scott Lawrence is like, we need to make an agency to police this, who's going to lead that? And McComb's like, I'll do it. And the senior senator there says, young Senator McComb. And I'm like, oh, he is young Senator McComb, isn't he? Because the older one is the future one. Yeah. It's like his character's name is literally young Senator McComb.
That's right. Yeah, so in that first scene, I think it's time to deconstruct the time travel logic here.
Yes.
And like you said, it's delivered in exposition, not only how it works, but the fact that you're not going to understand. So let me break it down for the layman.
Technology is all in the folders in front of you. You won't understand it any better than I can. Now,
you can't go forward because the future hasn't happened yet. However, you can go back, and that's where things get real tricky.
It turns out if you go back and you change something, it's serious. It could be catastrophic. It's like throwing a stone in a lake, and it causes ripples in the water, only now they're ripples in time.
You won't understand it any more than I do, so...
Right, and that's great. I'm going to do my best to lay this out in a way that makes sense to you, Mr. Dumb Senator. Because the audience is always going to feel smarter than that guy. I mean, this is the guy that made the Star Trek joke a couple minutes ago.
Good
who conflated transporter technology with time travel technology. Well, like a doofus.
So what's the first thing you pull out of that?
First thing, time travel exists.
There's something glaring to me.
But you cannot go forward.
Yes.
Because the future hasn't happened yet.
Yes.
And yet, you can go backwards, make changes, and then go forward.
Yes.
To a future that theoretically hasn't happened yet.
Right. Why did they even put that stipulation on
there?
Well,
because they didn't want this to be a movie about going to the future. They wanted it to be a movie about going to the release date.
But it's so there's another way to say that.
The very next thing, they talk about not being able to go back and make any significant changes because it could drastically alter things. So you can go back and make minor adjustments or correct things and then come back, but you can't do anything that's going to drastically alter the future and be able to come back.
But do they mean you're not actually capable of doing that? or that we know you shouldn't do that.
I guess it's presented more of a we know you shouldn't do that way.
Yeah, I think so. And what do they use as an example?
So you can't go back and kill Hitler, much as we'd all like to. Because for all we know, it could cause a chain reaction of events that could alter or even destroy mankind.
Killing Hitler.
Hitler. Yeah, right.
Yeah,
exactly.
See? It's the first place our heads go. Well, maybe not the first place our heads go. But it's definitely one of the three.
There is a 2003 straight-to-video sequel about going back to kill Hitler.
That I did not know.
Yeah, discovered that in a little bit of research post-movie watching.
We are definitely watching that. We should do an episode where we just watch time travel things about killing Hitler.
Okay.
I got at least two. Time Cop 2.
Uh-huh.
There was an episode of Doctor Who titled literally, Let's Kill Hitler.
All right, well, compile them. If you're out there and you know of some, compile a list for us.
Let's Kill Hitler is great, though. It's like not even about that. It's just like the first 10 minutes are about Let's Kill Hitler. It's great. But anyway.
Well, again, getting back to this, though, the logic of you can't go forward, but once you're back there, you can go forward. Does that mean you can't go forward past the point that you originally left?
You can just come back to where you started.
Yeah.
Is how I take it. There's another very weird device that is introduced later on in the movie as the means by which time travel occurs.
Right.
That raises all kinds of questions for me. And that's the little train car.
Yes.
The way this TEC is set up, the Time Enforcement Commission is set up, there's this small rail track.
I don't think it's supposed to be small, though.
I think it's small
due to budietary constraints.
It looks very small. It looks like one of those test tracks where they crash cars and the crash test dummies come out.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what it looks like.
I don't think it's supposed to be, though. I think if you're using your imagination, it's supposed to be like this big, long tunnel track or whatever.
Sure. Well, it's got to get up to 88. That's what I understand about it. So, so they get in this little train car. Keep going. I mean, it is. That's what it is. I'm not really selling it. But it shoots forward, goes through a portal, and then the riders eject from a portal without the car in, well, in this case, like 1994.
Yeah.
For instance.
It's really bizarre.
And then they activate another portal to leave, leap through the portal, and then come out of the portal back in 2004. In the car. Again. Where the fuck is the car?
Yeah, it's like they didn't know what to do with the car.
It's like, I'm just going to drive around the block, guys. You tell me when you're ready.
Yeah, and the portal that they're walking through is basically just that screensaver that they used in Sliders.
Well, so is the effect that McComb and McComb morph into at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
That's pretty rough.
It's dating. But see, here's the thing about the time travel, though. The first time that you really see it, the first time that they use it, he goes back to bring back his partner, who's
Lyle,
working for McComb at the fall of the stock market, buying up stocks that he knows are going to be gangbusters in the future and whatnot.
Yeah, like an oil company that he can buy for cheap during the Depression, and he knows is going to be worth a fortune in like three decades.
Right, right.
Hangs out in his Wall Street office playing future music and...
and reading USA Today.
Yeah. Reading future newspapers.
That's a newspaper, folks, for those of you out there. But in that scene, the first time you see time travel happen, he just kind of walks out of this portal, you know, all cool and collected. And the second coolest thing that you'll see in the trailer is them jumping out of the window of this high rise and in a free fall, grabs this guy and the bubble appears in the sky and he falls into the portal instead of landing splat on the street. And it's a cool moment.
Very cool.
You know, those are the first two times you see him actually time travel, and they don't show the little car on the track at all.
No, no, he goes through the portal and then they're back at TEC headquarters in 2004.
He arrives and leaves without the car.
No, we don't even see the car when they send Lyle back, right?
No.
Because Lyle goes before this tribunal, they find him guilty, and they reinsert him back
immediately.
It's
like the judge, TVA jury, or something.
Yeah, it is. They're like the TVA. Send him back to the exact moment he left, 1929.
Yeah.
And he finishes the fall and is killed just another casualty of
Wall Street
crash suicides.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
The cop down at the bottom that sees him drop, who has seen three jumpers already that week, says, "Poor bastard. Tomorrow might have been a brighter day."
Yep.
That's another good line.
That's
for your
line.
Time travel movie.
All right,
like that's another one I was like, "Oh, okay, I like stuff like that in a time travel movie."
Fair.
Right.
So, as far as the rest of this time travel logic, I think the big elephant in the room, the one that I feel like everyone has to understand makes no sense, is this notion that the same matter cannot occupy the same space at the same time.
The same matter can't occupy the same space at the same time. It's in the technical reports. However, it's never happened.
There's a very good reason why that doesn't make sense. And that's because we are constantly, as humans, shedding and gaining new matter.
Yes. And outside,
like, we are not composed of the same matter now as we were 20 years ago.
And outside of that, even if we were, shaking hands with someone does not mean that our hands are in the same space.
Right.
Like, they're not still occupying the same space.
We are still in two different places. We can't just fuse together, but that's what happens, right?
Like, I don't know where this, like, when you're writing this movie, where do you come up with that and why?
All right, so Back to the Future 2 did a better version of this, where you can't meet your past self because it could result in a paradox, right?
Right.
Where your past self suddenly realizes, oh shit, I'm going to come back. And then you immediately alter, maybe in a way small or large, how your future self responds in that moment. You create this sort of cascade effect of minor shifts that ultimately result in this massive problem that might make the whole universe collapse.
But Time Cop doesn't give a shit about that.
No, Time Cop is like, let's turn him into CG goop.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of immaterial because they talk to each other all the time. Young McComb and old McComb.
Yeah.
You know, they have conversations.
Did you notice
more
that
than once.
Even when old McComb hands him that
the
envelope,
letter.
The letter with information in it, he drops it into his hand. He can't even hand something to him.
Right.
Without risking. It's like the paper would be a conduit.
Yeah. See, that kind of thing.
He's just
is
hedging his bets, too, because, I mean, everybody's told him not to do this.
Yeah, he's just being extra safe.
Yeah.
Extra careful. And as much as that makes no sense, matter's not going to be a conduit, the whole system makes no sense. But the dropping of the letter is good visual storytelling about how dangerous it is that they be in that proximity.
Quick, don't touch me. Same matter can occupy the same space.
Because at the end of the day, that's all that matters. Is
right. For the purposes of the movie.
Uh-huh.
But I question why come up with this. Anybody watching has to know that makes no sense, right?
Right.
I mean, there's like you were talking last week about some people don't understand time travel at all and can't even imagine that if they're the same character, how could they be in the same place?
It doesn't matter.
This is exploiting it. This is exploiting it in dirty ways.
People have to know that just because you're shaking hands with someone doesn't mean your hands are literally in the same place.
Right.
Doesn't matter.
I don't know. I still struggle with that, especially when there's got to be another way. Like the mutant thing with Looper.
Yes.
We constantly thought there's got to be another way.
Yeah. I feel like I sort of came around on that last week.
I did.
This one, no. It's not. I agree with you. There's got to be another way. And it feels like it only exists in service of putting what in 1994 was a pretty cool effect at the end of this movie.
Yeah. When you talked about earlier that this seemed dated, that's definitely one of the reasons. Even the time travel effect, that little bubble portal thing that we're talking about. If you guys, I hope you've actually watched this movie prior. It's free on YouTube.
And
free on YouTube.
It's also on the cock, guys. You can watch it on the Peacock if you haven't let your subscriptions lapse yet.
But yeah, it's definitely a 90s effect and probably what that Windows 95 screensaver.
That's
that
it. Sliders came out,
it
what, like
works.
A year after this?
Yeah.
And that effect looked so much better than this.
Really?
And it was on television, for God's sake.
I like it. Okay. I think it works.
I don't necessarily think it doesn't work for this movie, but I mean, like, yeah, this is the dawn of CG effects in film, you know? It really feels like you're seeing the very first instance of it.
Yeah, well...
It's a year after Jurassic Park, too. I don't know.
When you're seeing... I feel like seeing that in the movies back in 94 was kind of like, whoa, cool.
Oh,
you know,
it's fucking awesome in 94, yeah.
Yeah, but even now, I feel like it works. I like this notion of, like, stretching space. It feels like something time travel would look like. You know, you're bending space-time.
I love that stretch effect, especially when the train is going at it. And it's almost like you're just testing the tensile strength of the space-time continuum.
Of the space-time
and eventually
continuum.
You just pop right through it.
Exactly.
That
is
cool.
I dig
it. It's like a membrane you have to get through.
For sure. So... continuing with this time travel logic conversation, we can draw parallels, like you said before, to Looper, in that what you do to your past body affects your body in the future.
Yes, because we see that.
Yeah, we physically see that manifest when McComb suffers a kick to the face or something.
Yeah, Walker kicks him in the face and then cut to old McComb, and we see that cut in real time.
Yeah, the scar. And again, 1994, Nate sitting in the R-rated theater. Whoa.
Badass. Yeah.
That's cool. And it's still kind of cool.
No, it's still very cool because it's just like what we saw in Looper. But you don't have to sit there and say, wait a minute. Because in Looper, we were seeing people carve messages into their arms. And at that point, you're just living your whole life with this message carved in your arm that doesn't make any sense until you're there. Like, logically speaking, McComb could have gone through his whole life with that scar and it changes absolutely nothing. Right?
Yes, that's true. Paul Dano gets his foot cut off. Unlikely that he's traveling to the past.
That's changed a lot.
You get a little scar on your face. Doesn't necessarily change the actions you decide to take in the future. And I translate some of this headcanon-wise into this movie. Because I think that memories catch up to what actually happens.
I really hope they do. That was one of the things I put at the very end of the movie. I'm like,
at the very end of the movie,
I really hope they catch up or else the ending's kind of almost tragic.
No, I agree. When I put it in my own headcanon, I'm less bothered by that. But I really do feel like if McComb is back there conversing with himself in the past and setting himself on a trajectory, his memories must eventually catch up with him.
Yeah, my take on this is that there are no alternate timelines. There is a singular timeline that adjusts.
Yeah, it definitely works that way. Yeah.
Which is the same thing we get in Looper.
Right.
I think, right?
Well, Looper's just a mess. Who knows? But with this one, I think they're at least trying to make it make sense. And it's definitely same timeline, if for no other reason than in the climax of the movie, McComb corrects his goon.
When he's gone, you're gone. Get the younger one. I want him to see this.
He's dead.
No, he's not dead, you moron. If he were dead, he would not be here. Get him.
Yeah, that's what we call foreshadowing, folks.
Is it?
I mean, there's two things. One, don't touch each other. And two, if the young one's dead, then the old one's dead.
So here's the thing then, in that same argument, at the end of this movie, the villain's big plan is to let everybody blow up in that house, but it doesn't matter if he dies because his younger one will still become president.
You turned what was going to be a simple, ordinary murder into a bloodbath.
Right.
But...
and then negate everything from happening?
Yeah. Like, what? So the villain says that he will accomplish his goal and that his death doesn't really end his life, I guess,
because
the implication?
Yeah, like his future self will still become president and then he won't have to go do any of this,
so
I guess.
He won't die.
But the other thing to consider is that if all of them die in the explosion... well, no, because I guess young Walker is still outside. So there's no way he's going to die in the explosion.
Yeah,
right?
And at the time that McComb says that, he doesn't realized that his younger self was going to be there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so the younger self ultimately ends up showing there because Walker outsmarted him.
Walker outsmarted him and called him and said, hey, meet me here. And he thought it was his older self. It's amazing to me how dumb young Macomb is versus how intelligent he is 10 years later. That's the hardest thing in this movie to believe. It's not the time travel or anything. What a difference 10 years made. I don't know that anybody in the Senate is smarter 10 years later. I've never seen any evidence of that.
To be fair, I believe he leaves a message for him.
He's oh, like
actually like do a Macomb accent or something.
Yeah. That would be great though. JCVD trying to do a Ron Silver voice in the phone.
But yeah, that doesn't make sense at the end.
No.
I can't square that. And couple that with this same matter occupying the same space thing. Even though, if I'm fair, I should give it a pass, because they definitely set it up a couple of times.
Yes.
Storytelling-wise, it's just like, hey, the movie did the work.
Yeah, none of this is real. At least it takes the time to establish its rules.
Yes.
Right.
Give it some credit.
What the movie's doing at the end with the culmination of the Macomb plot is time travel sleight of hand.
Okay.
Right? You are not wrong to be zeroing in on Macomb and saying his plan doesn't make sense. Nothing about this makes sense. But at that point in the movie, the audience at large is mostly focused on is Walker going to correct the past and save Melissa?
She died because you came back and made some changes.
So now you're going to fuck with time. You're as bad as me.
Wrong. I'm setting it right.
Right.
Right?
That's the point.
That's the time travel objective here. Everything else is just noise in the background. And defeating Macomb, it's like, oh, we're bringing back that element that we told you about two or three times, and we're going to melt it on the floor. And you're going to think it's pretty sweet. But the whole point is, can future Walker and past Walker save Melissa this time and correct history? So that's where that whole trajectory is at that point. So I think it's just, no, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Look over here.
But it's so easy to just say, I'm leaving. You know, like to be holding your little remote control there and be like, this house is going to blow up and I'm going to escape to the future and you're not.
It is forced. It only happens because you need to give him time to shove the two of them together, show them melt, and then have him escape the house.
You also have to give him time to deliver that terrible one-liner.
Oh my God.
About being on Broadway.
You two should be closer. Keep him away from me. Same matter can occupy same space. I'm still kicking. I must be on Broadway.
Yeah.
See, that one's a bad one. That's a bad one.
God, there's so many bad ones. Here's some bad one-liners. He fakes out the thug with the clothesline at the end. Thug shoots the gun at it's just a shirt.
Yeah.
And then he knocks him down and he falls to the ground. And his response is, ooh, that's gotta hurt.
That's gotta hurt. It's gotta hurt.
Like, that's not a one-liner. That's not,
no.
What are you talking about?
How about,
who are you?
You're a smart boy. Why don't you sleep on it a while?
Who are you? You're a smart guy. Why don't you sleep on it? The goon. Who is this goon? I know that actor.
He also bad.
You know who we're talking about. This goon with the worst hair I've ever seen in a movie in my life. And although this guy is big, he's not particularly threatening. Like, I'll say if Jean-Claude Van Damme walked up next to that guy, I can't imagine him having any fear of that individual
So he mostly works as a stuntman.
Yeah, okay.
Like, he's not really an actor. Oh, I mean, all right, I don't want to get into that because stunt performers are performers. But there's a difference between being a stuntman and an actor. Personally, I think being a stuntman's probably harder.
Yeah.
But
I don't think we're going to get a lot of flack from the stuntman community.
I don't know. They are organized, man. But he's been in an ass ton of movies.
Yeah.
A lot of action.
Very recognizable face.
He's hired for that reason.
You're a smart guy. Why don't you sleep on it?
Yeah. Earlier we mentioned the freezing the goon. When he freezes half of one goon's torso and then kicks and shatters his arm.
Liquid nitrogen.
Yeah, liquid nitrogen. And his one-liner there is, have a nice day.
Have a nice day.
Yeah, like, what? Like,
huh? And then that's when he's walking away. He's like, I should have said freeze. like 3 minutes later.
I should have said freeze. I think he got the idea.
Which I guess is pretty honest. Like, it would be really hard to come up with those quotes in the moment.
Well, the problem is that...
Like, damn, I should have said freeze.
The jerk store called. They're running out of you.
I don't want to fight a woman. And then Fielding attacks him and he says, I changed my mind.
Yeah. The freeze line, though, needs to be delivered to McComb because McComb's the one that gives him a hard time for saying freeze the first time.
Right.
So just killing the goon with the liquid nitrogen doesn't work unless he later walks up to McComb and says, I should have said freeze.
Yeah.
But it takes too long.
Yeah.
It takes too long. Like, McComb's not just standing right there for him to say it to. He's like, walks down the gangplank a little while, you know, like it's like a scene later.
Yeah, he's had time to think about it. He's just
yeah,
like,
he's like, oh, that's
man,
what
I just never come up
said.
With these fast enough. Yeah. So, back to the time travel bit.
Okay.
As near as I could tell, there were three timelines at play in the movie. There's an original timeline.
And the house blows up in all three of them.
It does, yeah. That's the one, what do they call it? That's
the fixed moment in time.
Fixed moment in time, yeah, is the house blowing up. The original timeline, we don't see a whole lot of it, but a lot of it is implied, where Max joins the TEC, Michelle lives, Max discovers McComb's plan and investigates, and then McComb sends goons back to kill Max and Michelle, but only kills Michelle. That's
right.
Presumably the first timeline, right?
Presumably, yeah.
Most of the movie takes place in a timeline where Max joins the TEC after Michelle dies, eventually discovers the same concerns about McComb, starts investigating, eventually leads him to Michelle and their home in 94. 2004 changes a few times during these trips. This is kind of the Back to the Future 2 1955 timeline, where future Biff comes back to past Biff and gives him the sports almanac. That's essentially what's happening here. And the other element that's a lot like Back to the Future 2 in 1955 is older Max is trying to sneak around younger Max to preserve or correct history.
Right. I feel like it's pretty creative to start the movie with these goons breaking in.
Yeah.
Without us knowing that they're from the future.
And we see the goons in the mall.
And
up
we just
on that.
Assume that that's the natural timeline.
And
like
they're
the
here.
Main timeline.
Yeah, we can look at those goons, and he looks up at them and thinks, who are those guys?
Goons!
Who?
Hired goons!
Hired goons?
Because they look pretty leathery and menacing.
Yeah.
And pierced. But we can already look at them and say, okay, they are from a future, and they're here to alter the timeline that they're from.
Yes.
In the original history, we can assume no house blew up. That's the only condition under which the house didn't blow up, is in the original timeline before the goons came back.
Right.
And then the final timeline is the corrected timeline where McComb is erased in 1994 and Michelle survives.
Yeah, so the method for the villain's madness is that they cannot eliminate Max in the present, 2004, because he's too high profile as a TEC agent.
Yeah.
But if he travels back in the past and erases him as just like a Washington, D.C. police officer, then he's just another statistic, is the
exactly.
way he puts it.
Exactly.
Yeah. So why he doesn't travel all the way back to like 1954
and kill him in his cradle,
kill him as a baby or
yep.
whatever.
Nobody wants to kill a baby. Even the bad guys don't want to kill babies.
So at the finale of this movie, when he's saved the day, he's kicked the two McCombs together and there are the goo on the floor. The house still blows up, but that's the corrected timeline. So when he goes back to the future, back to his family and his son that he never raised.
Oh man, yeah.
It's the same house.
Is it the same one, or is it like a very similar one? They might have rebuilt it. Like the,
I feel like it's the same house.
Like the X Mansion.
Did they rebuild it from the ground up?
She really had some plans for that house. One of my favorite scenes in this movie, actually, is when Walker watches home videos of Melissa talking about all the plans she has for the house. And all of Walker's lines, older Walker is just speaking along with. Like he's saying,
because
like,
he's watched it so many times.
And it's the only way he can feel like he's speaking to her. This is an alarmingly touching moment.
Yeah.
In this movie. Great scene. But I think she had plans, so maybe she did rebuild the house. Or maybe she found a house just like it somewhere else. I don't know. But
looks like it's the same house. You're right. I made note of that scene. It is a good scene. I didn't equate it back to the house, though. That's a good point. But as long as we're talking about that scene, it is the one that leads into the splits on the counter.
Yeah, the kitchen split.
So the bad guys bust in while he's fallen asleep on the couch with what amounts to just being a taser. Like at the time.
But what a fucking taser.
Yeah, at the time like, I was like, God. Whoa, future weapon.
It hits that one dude and he almost catches fire, for God's sake.
Yeah. And it's got like a laser sight.
I'm like, that is not how those things work.
Yeah, so this is a big action sequence. It's not like a big action set piece necessarily, because it just kind of happens in an apartment.
Mm-hmm.
But this definitely sold the movie. It was in all the trailers as well. Water drains out on the kitchen floor, and the villain is standing in the puddle of water and shoots the electricity down at JCVD, and he jumps up, does the splits on the counter.
So he's not in the water.
And it electrocutes the villain. Great action sequence, and it just makes you laugh. You know?
Yeah.
Like, it's just one of those cool things that'll just make you laugh.
It makes you laugh in that way that you're just absolutely delighted that somebody put
this on
film.
Yeah, you're just having a good time.
Yeah,
yeah,
it's such a good time. And yeah, it is the money shot. That's why you get JCVD in your movie, because he can do shit like that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's the payoff to that scene. You know, he wraps that guy up in the towel and kicks his head a couple of times.
I referred to it as the old rag around the hand move.
I have it as towel kick.
Towel kicks, that's good, yeah. The knife fight part of that is a little, I don't know.
It's awful.
It's not the best part. The best part comes later.
I think this bears mentioning, though, as far as fight sequences go in this movie, the knife couldn't be more than, what, 4 inches, 5 inches?
It's a very small knife.
Blade. Yeah. And they fight like they're swords.
They do? God.
It's like a sword fight with 4-inch swords, and it looks ridiculous.
It does.
Like, I don't know how they put that on screen.
Thankfully, it only lasts about 10 seconds, but it
feels like an eternity.
It's really weird.
Because I feel like the fight choreographer just gave up on Jean-Claude Van Damme. Like, he didn't know how to fight with a knife. And I just kind of equate it to that awesome knife fight in Captain America.
Captain America 2,
The Winter Soldier, yeah.
God, so good.
Awesome knife fight.
Yeah.
Play that back with this little tip-tap, tip-tap, tip-tap.
Tink, 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 tink.
Yeah, it's so bad.
Yeah, but it ends with that counter split.
The counter split.
Most famous moment in the whole movie.
Probably so, yeah.
We talked last episode about the casual world building that goes on in Looper to sort of imply rather than explicitly draw out social disparity and things like that in the 2044 of that movie. The 2004 of this movie looks more or less like the world just looked in 1994. With only one real exception.
With one exception.
The cars in this movie are absurd. They defy explanation. All the houses look the same. All the streets look the same. The stoplights look the same. Everything looks the same. The clothes look the same. But for some reason, we are driving in cars that are completely covered. It looks like the surface of the Death Star. The whole thing's plated in nonsense.
Yeah. And there's no...
What the fuck is going on with the cars?
The only thing that I can think is they need him to be able to get home without knowing where his home is at the end of the movie.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. Guess.
The audience might ask, How does he know where he lives?
And they're like, oh, we'll give him a weird future car.
I guess.
They look so dumb. It's like they wanted to make the cars look futuristic because everybody equates the future with futuristic cars. That's the easiest path. It was true in Back to the Future 2. Even Looper. Looper, it's like the cars all have those solar panels on them.
The flying motorcycle.
Right. But I mean, the cars in Looper, I'm like, okay, because it doesn't look technologically sound.
Yeah.
This looks like a car from the year 3000.
And it drives like a Pinto.
It's not. They're not great.
No.
Like the Cybertruck. They look like Cybertrucks.
Like, did I believe that was a futuristic car when I saw that in 94?
I just felt like they tried way too hard. It didn't make the impact.
It's bad. And the inside is just as confounding as the outside. It's got all these weird readouts and buttons that you couldn't possibly need.
Meanwhile, JCVD still goes home at night and puts in a VHS tape to watch his wife's home movies. Don't comport with one another.
Yeah.
The one thing that this movie is extraordinarily prescient on, we mentioned it earlier, and that is McComb's entire election platform.
Yes.
Which I was just stunned by. The exact quote is,
"The country's gone down the drain because of the special interests. We need someone in the White House who's so rich, doesn't have to listen to anybody. When I'm in office, it's going to be like the 80s again. Top 10% will get richer. The other 90% can emigrate to Mexico where they can live a better life. So, Agent Walker, you're going to stay."
And I was like, holy crap. It's wild. It's like, that's it. Yep, that's where we ended up. Time cop, you got it right.
Yeah.
Now, here's the thing. Do you know what Donald Trump's favorite movie is?
Bloodsport.
It's well known. It's Bloodsport.
Bloodsport, yeah.
A movie that also starred
Jean-Claude
Van Damme.
Yeah, I mean, it is remarkable how on the nose that ended up being. Do I think that it was the precursor to Donald Trump? No.
That line, that little monologue right there in the middle of the movie, that's a timeless little nugget there.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
And it's also a great example of why we shouldn't have time travel. Somebody like that is just waiting to take advantage of it.
Well, yeah, let's say taking advantage of the time travel, you mentioned earlier some neat little tricks where they knew there were ripples in time that they could point to that say, oh, well, this must have been affected by time.
Something very cool early on.
Yeah.
The idea being that if there's a ripple in time, a minor ripple, people in the future aren't going to even notice it. That's the whole point. It's going to go untraced.
That's the whole point.
And even if they found out about it, it would just be part of history. The timeline readjusts. So how do you know?
Right.
You have to look for bizarre instances. And the movie opens in 1863 with there's time cops. I guess this guy's a time crook.
Time crook. That's the sequel.
I wish.
Time cock 2. Time crook.
Time crooks. This time crook is there in the middle of the Civil War, stops a bunch of Confederate soldiers that are carrying gold, takes the gold from them, and stashes it, and it's used decades later in an arms transaction in what, like Russia or Germany? And that's
like
how they
deal.
Found out. This arms transaction happened. And it's not unusual, except for the entire thing was paid for using Confederate gold. That's cool.
Yeah.
That's really
cool. That is cool. What's not cool is that they, for some reason, carbon dated gold.
Right.
So,
yeah. They're like, huh? It says here it's 2 billion years old.
Even if you could do that. It was brought forward in time, so it would not be that old.
Right.
It's as new as it was when you stole it. So
they didn't make the gold in a factory.
So it's like, good for you, movie. Yeah. Oh, you blew it.
You almost had it.
You were that close. And then you dropped it.
But cool idea, though.
It's a cool idea, and that's a really neat way of recognizing when things may have been affected in the past. Smart little movie.
Yeah, it's
but also dumb.
It's clever in a lot of ways. Dumb in all the right ways. I would say almost all the right ways.
That's a good way to put it.
It's like, I hate to use the word you can turn your brain off, the phrase you can turn your brain off, because I don't think you can turn your brain off.
I hate that phrase too.
in Time Cop. Like, it's not the kind of movie that you can just go and you're thinking on autopilot.
There's not a lot of things that I want to sit down and turn my brain off to watch.
There's literally nothing I can think of.
Really don't like describing things that way or even just dismissing things that way as though that's an acceptable form of entertainment. It doesn't do it for me.
I don't think it's that kind of movie, but it is the kind of movie where you can have some dumb fun, too.
Yeah, you know? Dumb fun is great. Like, Desperado is one of my favorite
movies. Dumb fun, yeah, absolutely.
I love Desperado. But there's something about this movie, when we break it down into pieces and we talk about, well, this is cool and that is clever, you know, and I enjoyed watching it. But then when you pick it up collectively as a whole, it's kind of just like, is this a good movie?
No, it's not good.
No, it's surely not good. I don't know. It's so weird. Like, I think the finale, the matter can't occupy the same space, the Van Damme doing his best,
you know,
but
what
maybe not.
I think? I think that this movie would be more well-remembered and maybe better regarded if it had come out in the 1980s. I just think that we as a culture had moved away from this specific kind of dumb entertainment by the mid-90s.
Yeah, maybe. But we're watching it now in hindsight, evidently not giving it the benefit of the doubt, right? Like, I'm still judging it as, like, this is kind of stupid, you know?
Sure.
But, like, I enjoyed it, so is it good? It's so hard to say.
Like, yeah, I guess like I'm thinking of it and comparing it to movies like The Running Man and stuff like that from like the 80s that are maybe better
Total
known.
Total Recall
now.
Is good.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Like RoboCop is good.
Yeah.
Time Cop's not good.
No, I guess so.
But it's enjoyable.
RoboCop's trying to say something, I think, though. It's like a little bit more heady than that. I mean, we're trying to compare the work of Paul Verhoeven to the guy who directed Relic.
Yeah, what was his name? Peter Hyams.
That's not a fair competition either. But as movies go, there are absolutely worse movies from the year 1994 to spend your time with.
And movies that you couldn't nearly have this long a conversation about.
Absolutely. That's absolutely
so true. Yeah.
One other thing this movie's got going for it, and that is that it ends with a song by the Smithereens playing over the end credits.
Yeah.
Time Won't Let Me. It's a banger, man.
It's a banger.
That Smithereens song is fucking rad.
Just before that music kicks in, we touched on it real briefly, but Max Walker returns home to his 10-year-old son, whom we assume he has no recollection of.
Well, we know he has no recollection of it because his reaction to Melissa is, oh, thank God she's alive. The son comes out. He's 10 years old because that's another subplot in the movie is that Melissa was pregnant the night she was killed.
Right.
Yeah, he has no idea who this kid is. He's missed 10 years of this kid's life. And this kid plays baseball, at least. We know that.
So, and likes hot dogs.
Oh, he does. So that's why I have to believe that eventually Walker's memory will align with what reality is. Because otherwise, you miss 10 years of your kid growing up.
Will the rest of it disappear, or will he have some kind of memory of both timelines?
Macomb, yeah, all of that. Questions.
Whatever you feel like is going to happen,
this was,
you can let happen.
This debate was like the 1994 equivalent of did the top stop spinning or did it keep spinning forever? Believe me, it was like the same level of discourse among the fan community. Man, did Walker remember?
Yeah, I'm sure they were all digging.
Everyone had
deep.
Their theories at school the next day.
There's a point at the very end here where basically she just asks, how was your day at work?
Yeah.
And my brain immediately went to, well, today was the day, honey. Like, he could tell her.
Because she knows. This version of Melissa knows what happened.
She lived through that whole thing where there were two of them. And she understands, at some point, my husband went back in time and saved my life. Right?
Right.
And that evening, they could have the conversation.
Yeah.
I'm back. Today is the day that I return from the future. You probably couldn't talk to me about for 10 years.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, right.
I mean, well, actually, he saw himself, too.
Right. Yeah, there's that weird moment where he saw himself.
There's that moment where he sees himself in the past.
I think I know this guy.
Yeah, none of that's erased. They're both fully aware that this thing is going to happen. They're not going to take the time to do that in the movie, but the movie came to a close. That's what I was thinking. I was like, oh, they're going to have a hell of a conversation over dinner.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, Brian, did you have anything else about Time Cop?
No, I think that pretty well covers it, honestly.
Okay. Well, there's a little gimmick I wanted to add to our repertoire here. You know, every one of these movies is going to have their own spin on time travel. You know, what does it look like? How does it work? You know, and I thought it would be really fun to kind of rank them as we go.
Okay.
And kind of get a list of what we think are really cool methods of time travel. But what's the metric by which we would measure this?
It's not going to be, is the movie good?
Oh, no, it's not. This is narrowing down specifically to their method of time travel. Do I like the bubble effect on the screen? And what do I think of the little car?
Okay, so like, the actual method of time travel.
Yeah, like the actual method of time travel. Not how do they treat time travel, because that's like a whole conversation, right?
It's going to be like a snowball going down a hill where every week we'll spend an increasing amount of time comparing all these methods of time travel. So
at this juncture, unless you want to include Quantum Leap, we've got the two, which in Looper, they put him in a chamber
see. Like a bathysphere and then just like...
That we never see. And then the effect is he appears or disappears.
Yeah.
In Time Cop, we would have to measure it as they've got that cool little triangular car on a track that zooms them towards the past and the bubble effect.
That stretchy effect specifically.
That stretchy effect.
Yeah.
But we should also probably factor in that they travel to the past in the car, but then arrive out of the car somehow.
Standing up
or falling into water because it somehow doesn't know where
in
space they're delivering them.
Yeah.
But sometimes it does, but, you know, whatever. But the reason I bring this up is because of how much I really, really like this one.
Okay. All right.
I like this one a lot. And I feel like if we're going to do this, we should try and come to a
consensus
agreement.
On it.
I don't want a list on your list and my list. I think we come up with a consensus. And day one's going to be pretty easy because which one do we like better?
Yeah. I'll tell you, I do like the Looper one. You can't go forward. It's just basically a microwave you sit in, and then it just plops you into the past, and that's it. And then you just appear there. I think as far as the coolness factor, obviously Time Cop takes that.
Yeah.
It mixes a bunch of things together. Like, I feel like the little train car is there specifically because Back to the Future was a thing. Cool to have a fast-moving vehicle that propels you into the past.
And it looks neat.
It does look neat. Now, I say the departing effect looks great. The train car hitting that barrier and stretching it and then like penetrating it. That's cool.
Yeah.
The ripple effect that's just like the weird screensavery one that they just like walk out of, considerably less cool.
When they're just walking out of it, but when they're falling
into
out of the window.
Very good.
That's cool.
That really does work. So I would give the edge to Time Cop here.
Okay.
For sure.
I'll do the same, because I think where Looper fails is that they don't really show you the machine.
No, you just see the interior of it.
You see the interior of it. It's like an oven, basically.
It really is. And then it just makes a lot of noise. It's like a really noisy oven.
Well, see, the good thing about Looper is that it really fits with the movie.
Yes.
Like, you wouldn't want a bubble effect in that movie.
No, it's not. They're not trying to.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
You're not going to see that. You're not going to see anybody doing sweet-ass splits moves.
No.
In the Looper either.
It's not that movie for sure.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, folks. Remember to subscribe to the feed so you never miss an episode. Review the show for us, won't you? We'll read them. So keep it clean. Or don't.
Or don't.
I mean, it's late in the episode. We drop F-bombs all the time, whatever. But do tell anybody in your life that you think could benefit from hearing about the 1994 film Time Cop to listen to this podcast, or if they just like time travel.
Let's be honest. Who couldn't benefit?
Yeah, I mean, like, this is something for everyone in Time Cop. Really, there is, I think. Because you got the splits, You've got...
the boobs.
Oh, you got titties.
Yep.
Pete Lentz. Pete Lentz is going to love those. And Mia Sara. And that,
not Mia Sara's boobs.
Well, no, they're in there too.
Are they?
Yeah, they are.
Right.
That YouTube one might have been edited. You got to watch it on the cock if you want to see the uncut version. And we all like that uncut cock material. Anyway, leave us a review and say whatever you want.
Or please don't.
We're available on YouTube. In an audio format, you can like, comment, and subscribe there. You can send us emails at ohboyqlpod@gmail.com. Look for us on social media. I'm CaptainBern on Blue Sky, Captain Byrne. And I'm Brian.Lee.Martin on Instagram and Threads. And Nate's out there, too.
I am at ActionNate on both Blue Sky and Threads. And I'm going to start trying to post ahead of time what it is we're talking about that week. So
good.
Look out for posts. Try and follow me on one of these here social media networks so that you know what you need to watch in order to join the conversation.
Or read. You're anything like Nate, you need about a month head start.
I have not cracked the spine on that book yet.
But yeah, that's it, folks. Thanks for listening. As always, I am Brian.
And I'm Nate.
And we'll see you in the future.